And now we begin the Find Your Life Purpose online event. Please welcome Dr. Wayne Dyer.
Good afternoon or good morning, wherever you are around the world. This is Wayne Dyer talking to you from rainy Maui. It's nice to come in the afternoon. It's 2 o'clock in the afternoon here. And welcome to all of you. We'll be together for the next couple of hours. I'm going to conduct I guess it's called an online seminar. I don't know too much about online. I don't even have a computer. Most of you know I write everything I do by hand, and I just take notes, and I speak mostly from my heart. The theme of this seminar that I was asked to put on, and that you all so graciously signed up for, is From Ambition to Meaning. If you don't recognize what that is, it's also the title of a movie that I've just completed, that has just been released, with starring Portia de Rossi and Michael DeLuise and Shannon Sturgis and Ed Kerr and others. And it's four stories all wound together in trying to get across this message about moving in our lives from a place of ambition to meaning. Some people think that the word ambition is misused there, that having ambition is something that we're all taught to have, and it's the most important thing we can have is to be motivated. I've often said that the difference between being highly motivated and inspired is something that most people don't understand, and perhaps I can start out this seminar with that a highly motivated person, in fact, I've been called many things in my life, but I've also been called the father of motivation by pundits and people who write about me and so on. I don't know how I got that title. I've got 8 children. I don't need to be father of anything else, I'll tell you. That's enough of a job. But when you think of yourself as motivated, a highly motivated person is a person who gets a hold of an idea and has something that they really want to do, a goal, an objective, a purpose, something that they'd like to fulfill, something they'd like to accomplish in their life. And a highly motivated person is someone who gets a hold of one of these ideas and then won't let anything get in its way. So that any obstacle that comes out is just something that you just plow through, and you don't listen to anybody telling you what you can't do. And you push forward, and you have a lot of drive, and you have a lot of ambition, if you will. And there's nothing wrong with that in the world. The second thing that I'd like to say about that is the difference between motivation and inspiration is that if motivation is an idea getting a hold of you and you taking it where you want it to go in your life, that inspiration, the part of our lives when we return to a place called meaning, is the exact opposite of that. That's when an idea gets a hold of you. And this idea gets a hold of you and takes a hold of you, and it is so strong within you that you surrender to it and you let go and you begin to have a sense inside of you that there's a calling, that there's something that you are here to do. We call it, in the movie, I talk about it as as Dharma. And Dharma is really nothing more than a... like it's a Sanskrit term that means to have a sense of a purpose in your life, to have that there's something that you are here to do. You may not have it clearly delineated, and it may not be exactly spelled out the way so many things in our life we tend to do that, but it's something that we just feel and we carry it with us. And I know in my own life it's when people say to me, why do you continue to keep writing, and why do you keep speaking, and why do you continue to do seminars and this kind of thing? You certainly don't have to work anymore, and you could just relax and just and let it all just unfold as it will. And a part of that resonates with me, but there's also something that I know deep inside of me. I remember someone asked Madonna, the singer, a question about why she continues to sing. And her answer always kind of struck me. She said, "I always feel that if I didn't sing, I would die. It would kill me. That I just it's just something that gets a hold of me, and something that I absolutely have to do. I have to perform." And I remember the great playwright Arthur Miller, who wrote *The Death of a Salesman* and you know, so many of the great plays. American, considered probably the finest American playwright of the last century. He was 90 years old, and he was asked the question, "Are you working on another play?" And I remember, I'll never forget his answer. He said, "I don't know, but I probably am." And that really resonated with me, this whole idea that that here was this great playwright in his ninth decade of life, and he was still saying, "I'm not sure, but I probably am," meaning that there is something, there's something bigger, there's something greater, there's something that we can connect to in our lives. I've written books about this. I wrote an entire book about this, basically called The Power of Intention, which looked at the faces of intention, the kinds of things that take place in the whole world of creation. And I'd like you to just be thinking about this as we start this online seminar, that there is a there's something that each and every person that I've ever met, or every patient that I've ever worked with, every client that I've ever had, every person that I've ever tried to help, all of my friends, myself, my family, my own children, my mother, my grandparents, whomever I meet, my very best friends, when they really get honest and really it all boils down, they always say, "There is something. I just feel there is something deep within me that I came here to do, that I came here to accomplish." And so much of that is not being fulfilled in my own life. In the film and in many of the lectures and tapes I've talked about something that happened to me when I was a young boy, and I want to share that with you here at the beginning. It was when I was 19 years old. I graduated from high school when I was 18 and went into the United States Navy. And I was on my way overseas, and I was assigned to the aircraft carrier, the USS Ranger. And it was the largest ship in the world at that time, and I was a 19-year-old kid, and I had just completed my schooling and also my basic training. And I flew from Michigan, where I grew up, out to California, spent a little bit of time with my Uncle Bill Volick, in Hayward, California. And then I took my sea bag, and it's very, very emotional, very, very strong remembrance for me. Carried that big sea bag. I can still see it. I can remember my service number, 5273796, stenciled on that bag. And I boarded the USS Vega, which was a refrigerator ship, a small ship. And my uncle handed me a copy of a series of short stories written by one of the great writers of all time, whose name was Leo Tolstoy. And Tolstoy was not only a great writer, he was a spiritual master. He had written some very powerful books. One of them, which is one of my Bibles, literally, is called On the Kingdom of Heaven is Within, where he was raised in Russia under the Tsars, and yet he took a very strong position on the words of Jesus and wrote an entire book about it. And he wrote a lot of great stories. He was known as the soul of Russia. Many people, they said in 1905 and 1906 he was the most famous man on the planet, because this was before television and radio and internets and computers and things. So people knew the famous people by the books that they wrote, and the War and Peace and books like that were huge at that time. And I came to know Leo Tolstoy, not individually or personally, of course, but through his great writing, because I've majored in literature for a while and read a lot of his work. And my uncle knew that about me, and he handed me this collection of short stories, and it was called The Death of Ivan Illich. That was the first story in this collection. It's a long story, about 167 pages. And he just said, "Wayne," he said, "before you get to Japan," it was a 29-day crossing, he said, "see if you can read The Death of Ivan Illich. I think it'll really make an impact on you." And I didn't really quite know what that meant or why he said it, but about 7 or 8 days passed, and I got over my first my first time at sea, my sea legs, and being a little bit sick to my stomach, and you know, getting seasick and all of that. But by the time I got accustomed to it, and then I didn't have too much to do on that trip across the ocean, and I picked up the book and I started reading it. And Ivan Illich was a judge in Moscow, and he hated everything about his life. He hated his wife, particularly because he blamed her for all of the things that were wrong with him, all of the unhappiness that he felt, because he wasn't really fulfilling his dharma, what he knew that he came here to do. He didn't know quite what it was, but he knew it had a lot to do with artistic endeavors and so on. But here he was, a judge, going back and forth every single day, living the life of a commuter. And each day he would come back home and be unfulfilled. And you kind of knew what the story was going to, what was going to happen in the short story, because the title of it is The Death of Ivan Illich. And the last page, Tolstoy has Ivan Illich lying on his deathbed, and his wife is holding his hand, and he's looking up into her eyes. And the last words that he says as he goes off, as he dies, he said, what if my whole life has been wrong? And then he died. And I was 19 years old at the time, and I took out a pad of paper and I kept a series of notes, which ultimately became a book that I wrote called 10 Secrets for Success and Inner Peace. And I just kept track of what were really significant, what Abraham Maslow called peak experience moments. And that moment was one of them. I've never forgotten it. And I wrote a note to myself that said, "Dear Wayne, don't die with your music still in you, that you came here to play some music. There's something that you came here to do. And don't let yourself get to the end of your life and live the frustrated life that Illich led. Don't go through the motions. Don't let yourself be dictated by somebody else's ideas. Don't try to fulfill a destiny that somebody else has imposed upon you or somebody else has told you that you should be doing. Get past that and get to a place in your life where you know what you want to do." And at that moment, I said I was 19. I still had 3 more years to serve on active duty, and they were very important and powerful years. I traveled all over the world. Got to see places that a lot of young people don't do. But inside of me, inside of my heart, I knew that there was something that I had to do. And I was the only person. I grew up in an orphanage in a series of foster homes in my life until I was 10. And then my mom got her family back together, my two brothers and myself. Lived on the east side of Detroit and had very little, worked for virtually everything that I ever had. Most of the people in the place where I grew up on the east side of Detroit were, when they would graduate from high school, they would either go into the service and make a career out of it, or they would go to work for General Motors and Chrysler or Ford. Those are automobile companies, in case you've forgotten. It was almost like a destiny that I could see was being imposed upon me. There was much that I wanted to do. I had already written a novel by the time I was 17, and I'd written a lot of essays, and I had a real strong sense inside of me about wanting to write, but going to school didn't make much sense to me. My mom was going through a second divorce from my stepfather, who was an alcoholic, and it was not a happy time in those days with all of that fighting and all of the drunkenness and so on that was in the home. But there was always this part of me that just knew that I wanted to teach and I wanted to write. But everywhere I went, whether it was the school teachers who always told me whenever I'd write an essay and I would turn it in and it would come back and they would have red marks all over it and telling me this paragraph was awkward and you don't have the right kind of opening, and you don't have a sentence in there that's right, and your bibliography is wrong, and none of that seemed to make any difference to me. It just didn't seem like writing. It just seemed like just doing research stuff the way somebody else was telling me to write. And when I did write, when I did my own writing in my own space, in my own way, usually late at night after everyone was asleep, I would just sit and let thoughts come out. And people that were heroes to me were people that most of my friends didn't even know anything about. Henry David Thoreau, for example, and Emerson. I was reading them when I was in high school, but they always talked about the necessity of civil disobedience and the necessity of going within and living from your heart instead of your head. And they always made so much sense to me, but I was constantly being confronted with the way you're supposed to do things, the way you're supposed to write. Even when I took speech classes, I was told that I didn't give my speeches properly. I spoke too much off the top of my head and not enough from notes and wasn't specific enough. And I didn't have a proper introduction and I didn't have a proper middle and I didn't have a proper conclusion. And it just never seemed like the way to do things. And there's many, many pressures on all of us. And many of you here who are listening to me today, I'm sure, can go back into the earlier years of your life or even more recently and come up with a lot of reasons why you never got to the place in your life where you were doing it your way. You know, the famous American poet E.E. Cummings, he was the guy who did everything in lowercase. I always liked that. He said these words. He said, "To be nobody but yourself in a world which is doing its best night and day to make you just like everybody else means to fight the greatest battle there is to fight and never stop fighting." And while I don't think of it's a battle, and I don't think that involves any fighting, in fact, I think fighting is probably the least effective way to get there, there has to come a place within us, a time, an event, a set of circumstances, a synchronicity that you can't explain to anyone else, that when a moment shows up and you say, "This is what I'm here for. I know that I have to do this." And I have spent a lot of the years of my life writing books, particularly, and producing programs, CD programs and tape programs, and now even a movie, trying to teach people about what it is that you can do and how you can go about making this shift away. So when I think about the title of this program that I was asked to do today, From Ambition to Meaning, there's four words there. Those four words, I think, tell us an awful lot. The first word is from. And I'm going to organize this seminar around these four words. And the most important and the most amount of time that I'll spend is on something called meaning, because I want to try to get as specific as I can a little bit later on with what it is that constitutes feeling purposeful, living in the afternoon of your life and feeling as if what you're doing is exactly the right thing, what you signed up to do, if you will. And Lao Tzu said a word this way. He said, "Every human being's essential nature is perfect and faultless. But after years of immersion in the world, we easily forget our roots and we take on a counterfeit nature." And a counterfeit nature is really what my teachers have called the false self, the part of us that isn't really, it isn't authentic, it isn't real, it isn't who we are. And I think it's very important for us to remember those words. Let me give them to you again. Every human being's essential nature is perfect and faultless. But after years of immersion in the world, we easily forget our roots and we take on a false nature or a counterfeit nature. So where did we come from? Most of us, when we look at that question and we answer it by saying, well, we came from our parents, and they were Italian and I'm Italian. They were Jewish and I'm Jewish. Or they were Southerners and I'm a Southerner. I've always liked the question. and ask it of myself a lot. Who would you be if you didn't have anyone to ever tell you who you were? Who would you be? I have gone inward on that question in deep meditation on many occasions. And the response that I have come up with is that who I would be would not be even a man, would not be a writer, would not be a father, would not be a teacher, all of the things that I have done in my life, that if I didn't have anyone to ever tell me who I am and who I should be, what I would be is a divine piece of some organizing intelligence, some invisibleness that is that has always fascinated me. I wrote an entire book on this subject called Change Your Thoughts, Change Your Life, Living the Wisdom of the Tao. Lao Tzu, this great Chinese teacher from 2,500 years ago, called this invisibleness that we all originate from, he called it the Tao, T-A-O, the Tao. And in the opening lines of his great classic text that some call the wisest book ever written, the Tao Te Ching, which simply means the book of living the virtues of the great way, which means to be as Tao-centered or God-centered as you possibly can be. And so where we came from, if you take this tiny little drop of human protoplasm that began you and put it under a microscope and examined it for as strong a microscope as you could get, you would find that that tiny little infinitesimally small drop of human protoplasm, this tiny, tiny little speck that you could put a million of them on the head of a pin, that the one that is you had a future pull in it, and that future pull, which you can't see, no one can see, had everything that you needed for this entire physical journey that you have undertaken. Whoever you are, whatever the age of your body, wherever you live, however tall you are, whatever color your skin is, whatever your eyes look like, whatever the shape of your nose, however many inches you are tall and how many pounds you have on you, all of it, and how many hairs you have on the back of your head and on the back of your hands and in your nose or whatever they are, everything that you needed for this physical journey was in there. There was absolutely nothing for you to do. You just had to surrender to it. And as we look at this microscope and we look at this tiny little drop of human protoplasm and you ask yourself the question, the question that is burning in everybody's mind is, where did I come from? Not who am I, but where did I come from? Where did I come from? What is my origin? Where from? The word from. Where are we from? And in the words from is the awareness of truly what our origination is. And as I go through this, I want to read to you also the words of T.S. Eliot, another great poet. He said, "We shall not cease exploration. And at the end of all of our exploring will be to arrive where we started and to know the place for the first time." To know it for the first time. And this means that that to find out where we are from, what he is saying in there, I believe he's speaking about death, that we will ultimately return to the place from which we originated. And when we die, when we leave our bodies, we'll know it for the first time. I suggest to you here today and in my writings and in everything that I do that you don't have to die to know where you're from and to know that you're going to return. In the Tao Te Ching, I think it's the 40th verse, it says that the way of Tao is a return trip. You will return to the place from which you originated. And as we scientists look under the microscope and try to find out where do we come from, what's the building block of this little tiny infinitesimally small particle that is the, has the future pull in it that became Wayne Dyer or that became Mary Smith or whoever you are. And as we look and we study something like quantum physics, which is very different than the other kind of physics, Newtonian physics, which really studied particles and believed that the source and the origin of all things is in the world of the material, is in the world of form. And that these tiny little atoms were the smallest little particles, and that's what Newton studied. But now we know that with stronger microscopes and more accurate measuring devices, we know that atoms are made up of electrons and neutrons and protons and croutons or whatever it is that are in there. And then we look through those tiny little particles and turn up the magnification. We discover that there are within each one of those tiny little particles, within those little things called atoms, within those little things called molecules, there are things like that we call quarks. And they're so small and they're so strange. And as my my friend Deepak Chopra has often said to me, that quantum physics is not only stranger than you think it it's stranger than you can think. Because the nature of how particles behave at this tiny little space within each and every one of us, this place where things are so small, that the fact is that that just the way that you observe one of those particles determines how it acts. So that the observations that when you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change. And the things that you do that you look at do change as you begin to understand quantum physics. And there is not a cause and effect relationship between one particle and another. They're all connected. Everything is connected in this universe at the quantum level. So that it isn't just a clever little play on words that when we change the way we look at things, the things we look at change. It literally impacts everything in our world. And if you look upon the world that you're living in as an unpleasant place, as a scary place, as a place where fear needs to dominate, you'll find that that's exactly the world that you'll see. And it may look different to you than it does to other people, but that's exactly what you'll anticipate, and it will not disappoint you. So that what we think about and how we process things begins to become a very important part of the journey of moving away from the ego and ambition onto something called meaning. But we'd finally get to these tiniest little particles with our magnificent measuring devices, and we put them inside of something that we call particle accelerators, and we get them and we rev them up at 250,000 miles per hour. And as we do this, they ultimately they collide them. And as these particles collide inside of these particle accelerators, the scientists, with anticipation, open this thing up and look inside and examine it to find out what are the building blocks of nature? What is it that causes things to go, to come into the world of form? And we discover that the great truth of quantum physics, the great truth of spirituality, the great truth that can really change your life is that particles themselves do not come from particles. When they open these things up, these particle accelerators, and they look around, there's nothing there. They look and they look and they look, and you can find nothing but space, just empty spaces, and no particles whatsoever. And quantum physics are now discovering what Jesus said 2,000 years ago and what Lao Tzu said 500 years before him, that it's the spirit that gives life. The flesh counts for nothing. That where you came from is nowhere. Nothingness. No space. No particles. Only space. Only energy. You are a piece of formless energy. And that's your nature. And your nature is no different than the nature of everything that comes into the material world. All things that materialize, said Jesus, must dematerialize. Everything that comes into the world of form comes from the Tao, comes from God, comes from Source, comes from Spirit, whatever you want to call that invisibleness. And it doesn't matter what you call it. The opening line of the Tao, Lao Tzu says, the Tao that can be named is not the Tao. So now it doesn't matter what you call it, because the problem with what you call something is that that divides it into two-ness. You have the thing and you have the name that you have for it. But you're trying to describe something that is oneness, that is connected and is there everywhere. And you try to use symbols like words, and we lose it and we diffuse it. So where we came from, this great question from, is an invisible, pure, perfect, infinite intelligence. And we'll just call it, for the purpose of this seminar, we'll call it God, or we'll call it soul, or we'll call it the Tao, whatever. We'll just call it those things, even though as soon as you put a name on it, you lose it. And that's our origination. And somehow, in the great mystery of all things, we have moved from formless to form, from non-particle to particle, from non-being to being. And it takes place in an instantaneous split second. And that act of your parents commingling is really just an instrumentation for bringing the world of formless into the world of form. And in that split second, everything you needed for that physical journey is there. And so you go inside of your mom's womb and you stay there for 9 months, and all you do is just surrender and you just let go. There's nothing for you to do. You just allow. You don't worry. You don't worry about whether your nose is going to show up in the right place, or what color your hair is going to be, or what color your skin is going to be. It's all been taken care of. It has nothing to do with you. There's nothing for you to say about it or to do about it. And the great Lao Tzu put it this way. He said, you are doing nothing. You are just being done. You're just being done. And he says, let yourself be lived by it, which means don't interfere with it. Just like a deer doesn't interfere with its dharma, and just like a grasshopper doesn't interfere with its dharma, or an otter, or a rose, or a thorn, or anything in the universe, it just is. It just comes in, and it's got a dharma, and it will fulfill that dharma, and then it will go back to nowhere. From nowhere, N-O-W-H-E-R-E, to now here, N-O-W-H-E-R-E. And so this tiny little speck that came from nowhere grows and grows and grows, and 9 months later it pops out, and there's this beautiful creation. It's a mystery to all of us. Those of us who are parents, I've been there. I've seen this happen on 8 different occasions in my life, and it's just the most sensational, awe-inspiring miracle to hold this creation in your hands and to look at into the eyes of this beautiful baby, and you say, great work, God. Couldn't be any better. We'll take over from here. And this is the mistake that happens as we begin to take over, we begin to interfere. And to me, it's never been too great a stretch to say that if everything that you needed, every single one of you listening here today, if everything that you needed for this physical journey was taken care of by a force that is doing nothing, but leaving nothing undone. It does nothing. God's doing nothing and leaving nothing undone. There's no action. There's nobody having to interfere. There's nothing. It's just allowing. It just is. That if everything you needed for the material world, for the physical world, for your corporeal world, for the body that you're in, everything was all handled for you. There was nothing for you to do. And a lot of times we start to think that we're in charge, that this ego of ours is something that's in charge. And that's such a gigantic illusion, because you know what? If my ego were really in charge of my life, I would not be 68 years old and living in the evening of my life. I would be 23 or 24, and I would have all of my strength and my vitality and my youth and my health and all of that. And I would just say, okay, since I'm in charge, I'll just stop this process of this body aging and getting older and so on, and the hairs falling out and growing in places that I don't need them to grow, and all of the things that take place in the body. If the ego were really in charge, that would be what we would all do. But it isn't in charge, and we know that. There is something grander, something bigger, something greater that we're connected to that's in charge of it all. And you have to surrender to that. Certainly every one of us surrenders. It doesn't make any difference how much power you have, or if you're the king of the entire world, you still are going to return to the place from which you originated. There is no question about that. there's a line in A Course in Miracles that has Jesus speaking, and Jesus says, if you want to be like me, knowing that we are alike, I will help you. If you want to be different than me, I will wait until you change your mind. And you will change your mind. You may have to die to change your mind, but you will change your mind when you return to the place from which you originated. And I suggest here this afternoon to all of you listening today that not only was everything that you needed for this physical journey taken care of in that tiny little speck of human protoplasm, but everything that you needed for the spiritual journey that you're on, for your personality development, for your occupation, for the kinds of things that you're going to do, all of that was taken care of as well. And that's the beauty of reading the Tao Te Ching, and that's the beauty of what I'm speaking about here, is that we are so encouraged to practice non-interference, to to let go, and to just allow and let God. It's been a big part of the growth process for me, moving from ambition to meaning. So that takes care of from in somewhat of a sort of a bizarre way. That we came from a divine spiritual energy that has no beginnings and no ends, that has no form. And there's just lots and lots of evidence, even scientific evidence, to establish this. This is not a religious idea at all. It is just the nature of how creation takes place. And then we move into the second word, which is ambition. And in the moment that we say to God, great work, God, thank you for this beautiful creation that I'm holding in my hand, we then move away from God by edging God out, by saying, we'll take over from here. Deepak and I have often talked for many years when we used to speak more frequently, when we used to tour around the world and speak to audiences together. We used to talk just sort of excitedly internally about what it would be like to take children who were born and to let them continue to develop and evolve exactly as they were intended to evolve from this power of intention place, and to practice total non-interference, to just allow them. I have a friend here on Maui. Her name is Tiffany, and she has a little girl named Ohia. And she raised her for the first 4 years in the jungles out in Maui, and some of the more remote places of the island, where it's very jungle-like, and it's a it's like a rainforest. And in the Continuum Project process, they talk about non-interfering with children, so that people who practice this, like in more remote places, never tell their children to be careful. And they never tell them don't fall, and they never tell them, you know, that if they do fall or they scratch themselves, that that I'll take care of it for you. There's built into this system, it's a fascinating system, in which you you just assume that a child knows exactly what to do, and you never interfere with them whatsoever. So even if they walk close to the edge of a cliff, if they have an internal knowing that there's danger there, they're much more likely to fall. But if they are just trusted that to know what they are doing, very much like a mountain lion or an elk or any animal is out there, it really kind of knows what is safe and what isn't safe, and it trusts within itself. But if you were constantly telling that child that something's going to happen to you and this is a fearful place and so on, so that idea of non-interference is a very big part of moving from ambition into meaning in our life. So we take this little baby, this perfect little child, which was you, and we say, we'll take over from here. And what we do is we just edge God out. E-G-O, we edge God out. And in the process of edging God out, we take away the authentic part of the individual, the part of them that is really, when I ask the question, who would you be if you didn't have anybody to tell you who you are or what you can do? You would discover as you go into a deep meditation that you really are God. You really are a piece of what you came from. And in the film, Ambition to Meaning, I spend a lot of time in there. A lot of the people who are going through their their development in there are beginning to learn this very thing, you know, within themselves, that that it isn't blasphemous to say that I am God, that I am a piece of God. I remember hearing my teacher, Sai Baba, over in Puttaparthi in India, speaking to a group of devotees on his 75th birthday. I saw a film of it, and one of the Western observers there from one of the magazines here in the United States asked him the question in front of everyone, hoping to sort of embarrass him, and said, "Are you God?" Here was this man who was living at this God consciousness, at the highest place that a person can live at. And he was saying, "Are you God?" Because he was performing miracles and manifesting vibhuti in front of everyone. And Sai Baba looked at him and said, "Yes, I am." And he said, "And so are you." He said, "The only difference between you and me is that I know it and you doubt it. And somehow you've come to doubt your divinity." And the ambition part of our lives is when we take on this false self. And the false self is a movement away from the divinity from which we originated and onto a set of ideas about that defines who we are. I've talked about them before. I'm going to talk a little bit about them, and then in about 5 minutes or so, I'm going to open up the phones and perhaps I can hear from some of you. I'd like to hear from people, especially if you've seen the film and seen the movie. I'd love to hear if you talk about that as well, if you have questions. So in another 5 minutes or so, and then we'll go to the top of the hour, and then I'll spend the last hour on two and meaning. So this ego, this edging of God out, is the development of a false self, according to Muktananda, my teacher also, in Nisargadatta. Great names in India of divine teachers, and I've read much of what they've had to say and been very influenced by their teachings, as well as the teachings of Lao Tzu and Jesus and Buddha and Muhammad and Zoroaster and so many of the great spiritual teachers, and Mother Teresa being one of the most recent. And these are people who have learned how to live beyond something called ambition, because ambition is a movement away from God, away from Source, not in a religious context, but in a sense of who I am now gets to be defined in a different way. I was on a television show in Australia a few years ago, and on the equivalent of the Tonight Show there, and the woman asked me the question. She said, "What is your mission?" And I remember having a blurt out of my mouth. I didn't even realize what I was saying. I said, "My mission is to be God realized." And she said, "What does that mean?" I said, "It means," I remember listening to a quote of Einstein when someone asked him the question about whether or not, you know, he was interested in something about quantum physics. They asked him some kind of technical question, and he responded. He said, "To me, that's just all details." He said, "The only thing I really want to learn in my life is I want to learn how to think like God thinks." And that really makes a lot of sense to me, to think like God thinks. Like, what is this source from which all things originate? Everything that originates, every tree, every human being, every bee, everything that's out there. What does it think like? How does it work? And it seems to me that our mission to move away from ambition and into meaning is to get to a place where we are acting like that and thinking like that. And I'm going to go through some of the specifics of that in the second hour of this seminar. But to think like God thinks. And if you look at the way God thinks, I mean, I always tell people, so just hold up your hands and say, if these were the hands of God, what does God do with God's hands? And it's always just giving. It's just offering. It's just serving. It's in the name of serving. And so I encourage you to begin to look at the false self, perhaps, that you've evolved with. And it has six components, and I'm just going to go through them rather quickly. The first of these components of this false self that we get when we edge God out and take on this ego is a belief that who I am is what I have. And so if you believe who you are is what you have, and you've been trained to believe that who you are is what you have, then your objective is to get as much as you can. and to be in competition with people who are trying to get what you have. So competition becomes a very big, important part of life, and accumulating and ensuring and making sure that somebody else doesn't get it, and protecting it and being nervous about it. And if you have to get more, then the mantra of this ego internally as you go within is more. I must have more. And you get trained in this, and you get taught that this is my purpose in life. This is what makes me who I am. And the more I have, the more it makes me a better person than the people who don't have as much. And it's the cause of almost all of the things that that are problematic for us in the world. Lao Tzu, 2,500 years ago, left the village where he was living out in western China, and got on his oxen, as legend says, and he got to the gatekeepers, and he was leaving the village because he was living in a time of the warring states. Where people were constantly killing each other and always at war, one village against the other village, one persuasion against another, and so on. And he just saw the stupidity and the foolishness in that, because he said, you know, as the Native Americans so say so beautifully, that no tree has branches so foolish as to fight among themselves. And all of us are like branches on a tree called humanity. We're all just individual branches. And here we are fighting amongst ourselves and destroying the very tree that is who we are, which means our entire planet. And every time I look at history, and I taught history for many years, and I look back at it, and history is nothing more than the continuous fighting and killing each other and coming up with instruments to kill each other with even more sophisticated weapons and so on. And it's like our evolution as a people is in this false self, this idea that who I am is what I have. And in the Tao, it teaches you that take all of the things that you have and give as many of them away as you can. Keep only what's absolutely necessary, and don't live on surpluses, and don't accumulate, and don't warehouse what you have. But indeed, just allow it to come into your life and then move away from it. And one of the great things you can do to rid yourself of this ambition phase of your life, where your ambition is to get as much stuff as you can, is to just let go of it. Just to let go of it as much as you can. To go through your closets and take things that you haven't worn for the last year and just give it all away. If you haven't worn it in a year, you don't need it, and someone else does. And you can't imagine how good that will feel for you. And to do that with, I start every single day of my life, the opening words out of my mouth when I wake up in the morning, I thank you. Thank you. Thank you. It's open to the opening lines of the film. Hafiz said, if you only have one prayer that you give every day, make it thank you. And Rumi said that when you are born, a ladder is set up that is designed to help you to get out of this world, out of this physical world. And all you have to do is just recognize that ladder and find it. So that the idea that who you are is what you have is something you want to let go of. The second component of the ego is that who I am is what I do. So now we believe not only do I get defined by what I have, but I get defined by how much I accomplish and how much I achieve. And the more that I achieve, the more that I accomplish, the better I am. And in the Tao, again, it says, you are not what you do. It says, do nothing. Do less and get more done. Think small. Don't think big. A journey of 1,000 miles begins with an individual step, with one step. Just take that one step. Let yourself be guided by you are not what you do. Who you are, again, is a divine creation. Let this force that knows what to do, that knew where to put your nose, that knew what color your skin was supposed to be, that knew how tall you were supposed to be, that creates worlds, surrender to it more. In the recovery movement, we call this letting go and letting God. So the ego says, do more, accomplish more. The Tao says, God realization says, do less, interfere less, and you'll be guided. And let yourself be guided by it, and you'll know exactly what to do, and you'll realize you're not even doing it. Very much like what I'm doing right now as I sit here talking into this microphone. I'm just letting it come. And very much like what I do when I sit down to write, rather than struggling and fighting and working so hard on it, I just surrender, I let go. This is how I get through my addictions in my life, by letting go and letting God, and just knowing that there's something higher, something greater, that I can trust and that it'll be there for me. And the third component of this ego is the idea that who I am is not only what I have and what I do, but who I am is my reputation, what other people think of me. So we're raised to believe that other people's opinions are more important than our own and getting everybody to like us. So now we're out into the world. We've edged God out. We've taken on this ego, and we've taken on a belief system that I am what I accumulate, I am what I accomplish, and I am what other people think of me. And so we're always busy being consumed with what other people think of me. But the Tao says, what you think of me is none of my business. And it's one of the great lines I give it on my radio show here on Hay House Radio all the time, is just remember that what you think of me is none of my business if you're in a conflict with someone else about trying to be right, because the ego is always about being right. And then the fourth component of this ego, this false self, this ambition part of us. Now, you see how ambition plays a role in our life. It's like we're trying to get more. We're trying to get ahead. We're trying to get other people to like us. And then it says that who I am is separate from everybody else. And now we start to believe in our separateness and don't see ourselves as connected to everyone. We have to defeat other people, and war becomes the inevitableness of that. And then the fifth component of the ego says that who I am is not only separate from everyone else, but it's separate from what's missing in my life. But if you understand that this source that creates everything is, there's no place that it is not. There's no place that it is not. It must be everywhere, because everything comes from it and everything returns to it. And if there's no place that it's not, then it's in you. And if it's in you, and it's no place that it's not, it must be in everything that you would perceive to be missing from your life. So that whatever you would like, whatever abundance is missing, whatever relationship you don't have, whatever health you would like to have, that in some way you're already connected through it, through this invisibleness, this source, this spirit. And if you could surrender to that and realize that you're already connected to it and let yourself reconnect back to it and unrust the connection between you and this field of intention. And then the most egregious error of all is the belief, the sixth component of this ego, that ambition phase of our life, is that who I am is separate from God. And when we believe that we're separate from God, we lose our connection to all that is possible. Because there's no possibility of you ever being separate from God. But then we create religions and we create all kinds of organizations which have as their purpose to teach us, to have us believe that God is something or someone that's outside of us, that is keeping track of us, that is doing all of these things and is really a withholding God. And so we get into prayer and we pray to this being, or we pray to this religious organization or this entity of some kind, and ask it to please heal us of our illnesses, or to please make our problems go away, with a belief somehow in there that God, this munificent source of all things, is a withholding source and says, I have whatever it is that you would like to have, but I'm not going to give it to you unless you please me. That's man's ego creating a God that looks like an ego, which has edged God out. But if you really look at source, there's no judgment in there. And all you have to do is reconnect to that source and know that whatever you perceive to be missing from your life right now in this moment, you're already connected to it. It's already here. And once you get to know that and understand that and surrender to it, you've moved away from ambition and into meaning. And in the last hour of this seminar, what I would like to do is move into the words to and meaning, and what meaning really looks like in your life as you make the shift. In fact, the movie that many of you have seen, Ambition to Meaning, is going to be changed. The title of it is going to be changed, because I've just been looking at it and I've decided that it's really about the shift. And we're going to call it the shift from ambition to meaning. So maybe we can take the next 5 or 6 or 7 minutes and take some reactions or questions or thoughts that people out there might have, if whoever the magic person that's listening to this can make that happen. Hi, Mary. You're calling from Australia?
Yes, I am, from Melbourne. How are you?
I'm great. How's the tennis going down there?
Oh, great, great. We've been watching it in the evenings.
Yes, I have been too.
Oh, that's good. Are you coming to Melbourne soon to visit us? Because I'd love to come and see you.
I think I will be, yes. I was supposed to come in May, but I think we might be doing that in the fall of this year. That'll be great.
Oh, yes, I'll be there. Don't you worry. Thank you for blessing my life with your books. And
oh,
I got to see your movie yesterday. I got delivered from the Hay House yesterday.
Oh, you did?
So I watched it and I loved it.
Oh, good.
I watched it with my son, who's 13, and he's listening right now as well. I'm a little bit overwhelmed in talking to you today.
Oh, well, that's wonderful.
Yeah, thank you. My question is about letting go. I'm in a situation with work at the moment. Can I describe a little bit of my history
sure.
with work? I had a breakdown in December 07 with work. I was quite stressed and began 2008 with panic attacks and suffered anxiety and depression. I saw you on the Ellen Show in January 08. And there I started a journey reading your books and Eckhart Tolle's and Louise Hay, watched Oprah webcast, and I also learned how to meditate. I'm continuing with that path. And with the support of my family, I got back to work in July last year.
Mm-hmm.
And in Melbourne, the law is that your employer only has to provide you 52 weeks of suitable duties, and after that they let me go in December 08.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to forgive myself. I feel like I failed, and my past employers, and to let go of this story, so I can start looking for a new beginning. But I'm having a hard time in letting go. A lot of people think that I'm quite blessed because I've got this opportunity to start a new life.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm getting paid for it still from work, and they're giving me courses and things to do to find new work. But the letting go and feeling guilty, I'm finding hard to work with that.
Well, sure you are, because the ego is a very tough master. You've come to really believe so strongly, everybody listening, you've come to believe, wherever you are on this planet, you've come to this there's very few people ever raised. I remember one time someone said, why do you think Jesus turned out so well, you know, and had so much to teach us? And someone said, well, that's because his mother really believed that he was the Son of God, you know. And so he was raised, you know, on this awareness that he really was a piece of God. We're not raised that way. We're raised to believe in all of the things that I've just gone through, you know, all of this stuff that we've accumulated, and we forget our true essence is this divinity. You've got to go to that. I would recommend that you meditate more, that you get more peaceful, that you spend more time counting your blessings and being in a state of offering and giving. And listen in the last hour, because the last hour I'm going to give a lot of specifics about what it really means to live a life of meaning. And thank you so much for calling all the way from Melbourne. I appreciate
you.
God bless you.
Thank you very much. And God bless you.
Thank you. I'm glad you enjoyed the movie. I appreciate that. Okay. We have another caller. Mimi, are you calling me from New York?
Oh, yes, I am. Hi, Dr. Dyer.
Hi, how are you?
I am hit with the worst cold. I don't know if I've ever had a cold this badly.
Well, congratulations. It'll make you stronger. It really will. I just went through one of those myself, and guess where I got it? New York, when we had the premiere of our film just a few weeks ago.
Oh, well, I saw you at the premiere, and after listening to this, so far the first hour of this, I'm sorry that at the end I considered you a father figure. I told you that.
That's okay. I don't mind.
Dr. Dyer, I don't want to take up a lot of time. I'm sure everybody's excited who was able to get through. I certainly feel blessed that I have an opportunity to talk with you directly.
Thank you.
I'll comment on your film. I really agree with you that renaming it to The Shift I think it's a lot more powerful. And it just is going to grab people with one word that is going to resonate with them.
It's so interesting that you say that, because I always say, whenever I say the title Ambition to Meaning, people say, oh, it must be a lecture, or it sounds like a documentary, and it's nothing like that at all. It's a story, a compelling story about these ideas. So, yeah, we're definitely committed to making it The Shift.
Oh, I really agree with you, and I enjoyed the fact that it wasn't a lecture, that it was a movie within a movie, and that you were able to hang the story on characters. You could tell the story through storytelling. I really liked it. And thank you. I got a free copy after the show, so I'm happy to be sharing it
That's
with
right.
people.
Well, good. Well, let people know about it. I appreciate that. Yes.
I will definitely do that. And I think that's going to be one of the ways that you end up getting worldwide distribution. I think people are just going to keep sharing it.
Yeah. It's, you know, that's a quantum physics principle that you just described there. They call it phase transition. You know, there's like when enough people align in a certain kind of a way, just like an electron inside of an atom, when you artificially move enough of them in a certain alignment, then you hit what's called a critical mass. And at the moment you hit that critical mass, all the rest of the electrons automatically align. And there's been books written about that called the 100th monkey. You know, when a certain number of monkeys begin to behave in a certain way, boom, it happens. And even monkeys that are on other parts of the planet begin to also have the same behaviors. So all we have to do is just, that's why I'm doing this thing today. And that's why I'm sending films out and encouraging people to tell other people about it. Because through the medium of a movie, we can really change this whole planet. Because I think there's a shift taking place, not just in our lives, Mimi, but I think there's a shift taking place on our planet as well. And I think the election of President Obama is one example of that, where we finally, you know, it's like if you have a black father and a white mother, who are you going to raise to hate? If you're raised as a Christian in a Muslim country, who are you going to hate? You know, if you come out of the inner city of Chicago and become the president of the Harvard Law Review, I mean, who are you going to hate? You're going to hate the wealthy people? You're going to hate the poor? There's no one to hate. And I think that symbolically that, you know, I think his election and I think the changes that are taking place. Yesterday, the president of the United States spoke on Al Jazeera to the Muslims of the world. Something that for 8 years we haven't done. We've just assumed that these are all our enemies instead of seeing, you know, and this kind of thing. I mean, it's a shift that's taking place. And that's why we want this film to be, I think, seen by so many people. That represents not just shifts in our own lives, but shifts that are taking place on the planet today. And I think they're going to be completed by the winter solstice of 2012, in case anybody's keeping track.
Well, you could call Obama a bridge to somewhere.
Yes, absolutely. So that's wonderful. I like that. Well, thank you for your call, Mimi. I appreciate you. God bless you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Dyer. Could I ask you something personal?
Go ahead, real quickly.
I feel like I might have been hit with this terrible cold in order to have to face this shift in myself. I've been a stand-up comic, pretty successful for 10 years. Although I've always felt like I had a back burner dream. And I think I've always been afraid to pursue it. And one of your cassettes I used to listen to, Everyday Wisdom, said, just because you had a dream at 14 doesn't mean it's who you're dreaming you are at 35 or 40.
That's right.
And
that's so true.
I don't know if I haven't been as super successful as I wanted as a comedian because I didn't believe in myself, or should I now pursue the other thing? Or
be very careful, Mimi, not to evaluate your success on the basis of whether other people accept and understand or even get to hear you. If you're feeling good, if you're making a difference, if you've made one person laugh, just one person laugh and feel good about themselves, you got to count yourself as a success. Don't buy into that ego idea that you have to have a lot of people and a lot of fame in order to be able to call yourself successful. You know, you've done a lot of great things in your life. Absolutely. And take total credit for that. And, you know, it's like making a difference is really making one person's life better. Like this whole seminar, the thousands of people that are tuned in here today, you know, if just one of you feel a little bit better about yourself and extend that to someone else. This has been a very, very successful seminar. Okay?
Wow. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sweetheart. God bless you. And you're funny. I can even tell you're funny to look at.
Well, thanks a lot.
See there? I got made you laugh anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
God bless
you,
Mimi.
Thank you, Dr. Dyer. Bless
Thank you,
too.
Sweetheart. Mm-hmm. Hillary in Florida, one last call before we take a quick break.
Dr. Hello? Dyer, I adore you. We met 5 years ago.
Is this Hillary Clinton? Is this
now, just a minute. I'm Hillary Kavanaugh. I was actually named after Sir Edmund. My father was a climber, so.
Oh my goodness! Yes,
But we met 5 years ago on Kanapali Beach. I was a 6-foot blonde, running at you with my arms spread open. I'm sure that happens to you every day, though. And I hugged you, and I told you how much I love you. And I just do. I just think you are such a great teacher, and beyond father, I just love your energy. I tuned in to Hay House Radio and just watched the movie last night. Loved it. Loved all the epiphanies. Oh my God! And the synchronicity that led everybody to their awakenings, and and the teachers. You, of course. It was beautiful how you guided and your patience and just the love that emanated from you. And that's, I mean, it's who you are, obviously. There was no acting involved. You keep wanting an Oscar for this, but you didn't act.
That's true. I still want the Oscar, though. I mean, that ego still, every once in a while, still comes up there.
Yeah,
you know.
Okay. Well, it's going around the globe. I think it's happening. Your Oscar is on its way.
Oh, they're so beautiful. Thank you.
And the janitor, the owner,
Is he not the? Isn't he the most wonderful character in that film? I mean, a lot of people don't even realize. If you go back and watch it again and again, you're going to see everywhere he appears in the film, he's doing nothing but serving.
Loved it. It was absolutely gorgeous.
Thank you
for that. So I have a great deal of change in my life, and I pretty much, put myself in the position to. It's everything that I've known, everything that I've been, is gone. A brief history. I fell in love with a beautiful man and left the backwoods of Colorado outside of Aspen, where I had a very successful healing arts business, and just was certain that I was going forward with this beautiful man, and moved to Florida this past fall to dive on into it, and it just fell right apart. Now I know it's all purposeful and profound, but my Wayne, I'm on my knees, and I my business, my people, my family, my income, my everything that I've known, nature. I've just, I spent my last 30 years in meditation and prayer and nature, and now South Florida. I mean, no offense to South Floridians, but oh my goodness, it's frenetic, and so. I know I'm expanding, and I know it's a huge opportunity.
Well, Hillary, there's room here. There's room here on Kanapali Beach for a beautiful, tall, 6-foot, gorgeous blonde woman.
I've lived there. I've lived there 5 different times over my life, and that's one of the things. I do practice the law of allowing, and I want to make sure that I'm not taking action before I'm lined up. But I have to tell you, I feel. Because, my heart's, I'm healing my heart, and there's so much, the abyss that I'm in. So to line up where I am at the same time I want to run, and one of the places I want to run back to is Maui, because it is so sacred and healing, and
it
resonates.
You know what I would say to you, Hillary, about this man that things didn't work out with? Be in a state of gratitude for him every day. He taught you some of the great lessons, and you didn't have to end up, in a very bad place and go through a yucky divorce and all of that kind of stuff. I mean, it's like you learn great things. Be in a total state of gratitude for him, and then you just watch and see what happens. And listen to the last hour, because I got a lot of good stuff for you.
Great. And to connect with the Dharma, I mean, my purpose, I've never been one to have great ambition. To really get in touch in this abyss, how to do that?
Well, you're doing it already. Just let yourself be lived by it. The Course says there's only two emotions. There's only fear and love. And everything that's fear cannot be love. And everything that's love cannot be fear. So you're still living in fear. And I would get back to love and know that you've been guided and everything is just right for you. It's all just right. Even being in South Florida at this moment, it's all perfect. Just look around and look for someone down there in South Florida to reach out to and to help. My mom would be a good one. She lives in Boca Raton. She's going to be 93. She would love to hear from you.
Oh, I love that.
Okay, my dear. I've got to go because we're going to take a break, and it's going to be over before we know it. Thank you, sweetheart. God bless you.
I love you. Thank you so much.
Look forward to that another hug here on Maui,
I'll see you soon. I will see you soon.
Okay, bye-bye.
God bless.
All right. So what we're going to do now, everyone listening, is we're going to take about a 3 or 4 minute break, 5 minute break at the most. Just going to get a glass of water and and go over a few notes of what I want to say and then come back. Does that work? I'll see you in just a few.
Please stay tuned. We'll be returning to the live online event in a few moments. The Find Your Life Purpose online event now continues. Please welcome back Dr. Wayne Dyer.
Okay, we are back, and we've gone from ambition, and I don't want to think of the word ambition as a negative. It's just we're not going to talk about the shift, and the word to means a direction away from ambition as the exclusive domain of your life, and you still stay ambitious, but you become ambitious about purpose, about meaning in your life. A shift takes place. I won't have time to go through all of the things that I talked about in the film about this shift, this quantum moment. For me, I've had several of them in my life. I had one back in 1974 when I went to my father's grave. This was a man that I had grown up to hate. Everything I'd ever heard about him was negative. He'd spent years of his life in prison. He was a thief. He was a drug addict. He was a drunk. He was an abuser. He didn't ever support his family. He walked out on his family, and so on. And I never saw this man, and he was the reason I lived so many years in foster homes and so on until my mom reconnected and got us all back together. And everything I'd ever heard about my father was always negative, and I was filled with rage and so on. And I had a quantum moment, a shift. The shift was, at that time, was a shift away from hatred and anger and bitterness and rage. And I used to dream about this man every night and have just dreams about how much I wanted to just meet him someplace and beat him up or whatever. I would have these horrible dreams. I'd wake up sweating and so on. And then I ended up at his grave 10 years after he had died. I didn't even know he was dead until 1974. He died in 1964. At the age of 49, and I was notified that he was an indigent in New Orleans, and his body had been shipped to Biloxi, and I went down to Biloxi through a series of events I've written about and talked about in a book called You'll See It When You Believe It many years ago. But the bottom line on all of that was that I ended up at my father's grave. I found the death certificate, and it actually had my name on it as one of his survivors, which I didn't even know if he had recognized me as his son because I was an infant when he left. and I had a breakthrough experience in my life. It was I was able to forgive my father. In fact, my last book, Change Your Thoughts, Change Your Life, was written about... was dedicated to him, this man that I had never met, and I sent him love. And I did that then, at that moment in 1974. And I was able to forgive this man for all of the stuff that I had held him accountable for, even though it turns out that my father was probably the most significant person in my life. We don't always know why these negative things came up, just like when I was talking to a lady down in in Florida about being in a state of gratitude for these kinds of things. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross had a wonderful line. I spoke about it yesterday on my radio show. She said, if you shield the mountain from the windstorms, you'll never see the beauty of the carvings. If you shield the mountain from the windstorms, you'll never see the beauty of the carvings. And the windstorms of your life, those storms of your life, are what allow you to be able to transcend them and to get to higher places. I've just completed a book that'll be out in May of this year called Excuses Be Gone. It's also a PBS special that'll be starting to air in June. And it's something I'm extremely proud of. And everybody who's looked through the manuscript, all of the people at Hay House and my editor and so on, think it was like channeled writing. It just came through me about how to get through your life without ever using excuses again and live a God-realized life. Because when you're living a God-realized life, you're living as if you are thinking like God thinks, and God never thinks with excuses. Because excuses are just explanations for why things aren't the way you would like them to be. And if you put your attention on what you don't want or why things aren't the way they are, you'll just attract more of that. And it's really a very specific paradigm that came to me from Lao Tzu, I believe. I have a beautiful painting that was given to me by a woman in New York of Lao Tzu that she imagined. And I have it right here. In fact, I'm looking at it right now. And Lao Tzu just sort of said, here's a paradigm. You wrote a book about what to think, change your thoughts, change your life, but you haven't written yet about how to take lifelong thinking habits and shift them rather quickly and rather radically. And he dictated to me, somehow it came to me, a seven-question paradigm that when you apply it, you can make very dramatic changes. I speak about this. I'm doing an entire workshop on it here in October in Maui. I invite all of you to come. This will be the third year in a row, but this one's on excuses be gone. And you can find out about how to do that through however things work on websites, my website or Hay House's or whatever. So this idea and what happened at my father's grave back there on August the 27th, 1974, which was a quantum moment in my life, a very dramatic shift took place. And I was able to forgive my father. I went from rage to love and sent him love and thanked him, because if I hadn't gone to that place and been able to forgive him, and if he hadn't behaved in the ways that he had done, that the ways that he had behaved through all those years, the abuse, the abandonment, all of that, if I hadn't gone through all of that, I would never have gotten to this place of being able to forgive. And it was through that act of forgiveness that everything in my life shifted. My writing started to take off, and I took the weight off that I had put on, and I stopped drinking, and I began to attract the right people into my life. Everything in my life shifted, and all I had to do was get over that hump, and the hump was the anger and the rage and the absence of God realization that I was carrying around with me. And quantum moments can happen. I'm only giving my own examples. It happened for me 22 years ago now, almost, where I let go of drinking. And I had a quantum moment. I describe it in the film, so I'm not going to go through it now. But it was a very dramatic and powerful moment. And it was preceded by, again, one of those falls, one of those windstorms that come into your life that I had behaved in a very shameful way, what I thought was, and I was filled with remorse about how I had conducted myself at a restaurant, and I was drinking and so on. And the next day was, that was the last drink I ever had. That was 22 years ago almost now. And it came from a fall. So that every spiritual advance that you make in your life is almost always preceded by a fall of some kind. And that's what I say to all of you who have gone through the events that you describe as, isn't that awful, and it shouldn't be happening, and why am I here, and how could all of that happen, is if you can just look at them and see that the beauty of the carvings is going to be observed for you when you get into a state of appreciation rather than anger and bitterness, and begin to think like God thinks, which is always from a place of love and kindness. So when I talk about two, from ambition, that is the development of the ego, two, which is the direction in your life where you're headed towards something that allows you to feel more meaningful, feel more that you're on purpose, where whatever it is that you're doing, however it is that you're doing, whatever people show up, whatever events, however it unfolds for you, you have a sense that there's perfection going on here and that you don't fight any of it and you don't interfere. And you let go, and you get more quiet, and you get more peaceful, and you meditate, and you get to a state in your life where you're not fighting life any longer, and you're making that difference. And as I said to someone who called in earlier, it's like the lady who called in from New York about being a comedian. If you made one person have a happy moment in your life, you know, don't judge it on the basis of what the ego has taught you, that you have to accumulate a lot of money and you have to be this successful on these terms. And I go through that all in the film also about so much of that was in my life, earlier in my life, when I wrote Erroneous Owns and Pulling Your Own Strings. And I would evaluate myself on the basis of how many weeks I was on the bestseller list or how many times I was on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson or how many good reviews I had or how much money I made, how many books I sold. And I began to realize that those are the kinds of things that that no matter how many times you're on the Tonight Show or how many times you're on the bestseller list or whatever, there's going to come a time when you don't. And when if you are what you do, and then when you don't, then you aren't. Or if you are what you have and it's taken away, then you aren't. You want to get to a place in your life where it can never be taken away, where who you are has nothing to do with this material world that we're in. So the opening of the movie opens with a quote that I give from Carl Jung, from The Stages of Life. And it goes like this. This is the opening of the film, and let me just share this here with you. Thoroughly unprepared, he said, we take the step into the afternoon of life. Now, the afternoon of life is the shift from the morning of our life where we learn ego development to the afternoon of our life. Worse still, he said, we take this step into the afternoon of life with the false presupposition that our truths and ideas will serve us as hitherto. But, he said, we cannot live the afternoon of life according to the program of life's morning. For what was great in the morning will be little at evening, and what in the morning was true will at evening have become a lie. So if you are trying to live a life of purpose and meaning in your life and doing it by using the constructs and the truths and the beliefs that you had when you were developing your ego, your false self, you're going to be living a lie and you'll find yourself having difficulty. And that's why so many people on my radio show every week, there's always people who are trying to live a life of meaning and purpose, but they're going after it the same way they went after all the things that created the false self. Now, for so many people, they believe that this is a very difficult thing to do. It's very complicated. And the question they always ask is how? How do I make that shift? How do I stop evaluating myself on the basis of all of these ego identifiers and move into more of a spiritual awareness of my greatness and my divinity and what I'm here to do? And the best line I've ever heard from this that I committed to memory many, many years ago was from a great teacher who came over here from India in the early part of the 20th century. His name was Vivekananda. And he said these words. He said, go out. He said, when someone asked him that very question, how do I go about doing this? How do I tame this ego of mine and push it aside? And, you know, because you can't check into a hospital and have an egoectomy, just had this thing cut out of you, like an appendectomy. It's because there's nothing there. It's not real. It's the false self. It's just an idea. It's an idea, what I call a mind virus in my new PBS show and in The Excuses Be Gone. It's just a virus that's been placed into your mind from somebody else's mind, and its job of a virus, like all viruses, is to duplicate itself and to infiltrate wherever it has an opening and to spread from one host to another. That's what viruses do. And it's one thing in a computer and it's one thing in your body, but when it's a mind virus that's just been placed into your mind by other people and you've bought into it and duplicated it and infiltrated it and spread it wherever you can, getting rid of these viruses is, well, that's the whole basis of Excuses Be Gone. So Vivekananda had these words to say. He said, in the springtime, he said, go out and observe the blossoms on the fruit trees. He said, the blossoms vanish of themselves as the fruit grows. So too will the lower self, the ego, the false self, vanish as the divine grows within you. Let me repeat it. In the springtime, he said, go out and look at the blossoms on the fruit trees. The blossoms vanish of themselves as the fruit grows. So too will the lower self vanish as the divine grows within you. And that's really what living a life of meaning is about. It's about letting the divine grow within you. It's not about winning. It's not about, see, winning is just an ego identifier. That's what the ego says. I'm better than somebody else, and I evaluate who I am on the basis of who I'm better than and how much I have and whether I get the job or you or ahead of you and whether I defeat you and so on. And you can't do that when you're attempting to live a spiritual life. You have to move past that way of what you. And he said, you just have to think of yourself as like a container. And you have allowed so many ego identifiers into your body that you're filled with those. And he said, what you do is you just let the divine grow within you. So you just begin to practice divinity, a higher consciousness, higher awareness, a different thinking like God thinks, behaving like the faces of intention and the power of intention, living the ideas that Lao Tzu spoke about in the Tao Te Ching. Letting it just grow within you. And I'm going to go through what these shifts are and some of the key ones here in the last half hour of this seminar, so that you want to, as you think of yourself as a container, and the more divinity, the more that you allow yourself to behave in those ways where you don't argue with somebody else, where you don't try to make somebody else wrong, where you allow other people to be right if that's what they need to be, where you send love instead of hatred, where you stop needing to win, where you practice more silence, where you are in, like, I'm at a place now in my life where when I had real strong ego identification with myself, I used to dominate almost every conversation wherever we were, and I was very good at it. And I could talk anybody else down, I could make people laugh, and I could have all the attention on me if I wanted to do that. And I did it a lot. I'm sure I did it a lot. My ex-wife points it out to me, and she's right, I did. And now I find myself, when I'm in a conversation, whether it's with my children or with with friends or whatever it is, I find myself listening a whole lot more and even playing out. If I were to say this right now, I could change the whole tone of this conversation. I could bring it all back to me. But I'm not going to do that. What I'm going to do is just allow, and maybe just say a word or two to help draw somebody else out. In other words, I don't need to dominate any longer. I don't need to, because that's what the ego always tells us. We have to dominate. And you get softer. You get more flexible. You get kinder. You get gentler. It gets, you practice radical humility. And it's not important for you to win anything or be right at anything. In fact, you become what Lao Tzu in the 17th verse of the Tao called the spiritual leader, which is one where people who are being led don't even realize that the leader is there. And in the end of the day, they say, oh, we did that ourselves, which is how we want our children to think, instead of saying, oh, my father taught me this and he's the one that's responsible for that. You wanted them to be able to say, oh, I figured this one out for myself. So the idea here is to move to the meaning phase of your life by allowing these quantum moments to take place in your life. And the quantum moment, as I said, for me was when I quit drinking. It was a moment I've never forgotten. It's characterized by being, these moments are almost always a surprise. They're very, very vivid. They are benevolent. There's always a sort of a sense of love that comes with it. They're enduring. Very often there's almost like a breeze, and the smell of roses for me is a big part of this. I can remember that at my father's grave. I can remember it in the room when I had that moment and realized I wasn't going to drink any longer. And I just walked away from it. It was one of the easiest things I ever did. It was almost as if I just didn't want to disappoint God anymore. I just, and God meaning the highest part of myself, the highest place, the piece of connection that I have to this highest place. I didn't want to disappoint that any longer. And I can remember when I had this miracle over in Assisi that I talk about in the film as well. And again, the smell of roses, it was a breeze, and it was like I had a healing that took place from a knee that was going to have to be replaced. I was told that I had bone on to where I threw away my brace. And that was 9 years ago. It was in the year 2000. And it's... And it still stayed with me through all of these years, and I don't wear a brace, and I'm able to do yoga and swim and walk and do all of the things that I was told I would never be able to do with that. So these things happen when you allow these moments to come in, and you can invite these moments in. You can find a place in your heart to just allow it to take place. So what I want to do before I go into what I call the shifts, and there's seven of them that I'm going to go through here in this program. Then we're going to open it up to some calls toward the end. is I want to read you something from Lao Tzu. That's really, it's called The Unknown Teachings of Lao Tzu. And the Tao Te Ching was passed down from generation to generation through actual writing. It was written down and then recorded, and it's probably the most translated, other than the Bible, it is the most translated work on the planet today. And it's 500 years, that's five centuries before the birth of Christ. And then there's another, there's the unknown teachings of Lao Tzu, and these are ideas that have been passed on through an oral tradition, which is the way so many of the great ideas in the East, in the Far East, before we were able to write things down. That's how they got passed from one generation to the next, the great teachers. And the word Lao Tzu really just means old man. So it's whether it's one person or not. But there is something that happens when you make the shift into the world of meaning. And what happens is this identification with the ego begins to dissolve. It no longer becomes the primary way you see yourself. You stop seeing yourself as a person who is whatever they've accumulated. You start giving things away. Many of you know that the day after I turned 65, 3 years ago, I gave away everything I had. My office, all of my accumulations, my clothes, my furniture. I just walked away from it all and gave it all away. And even I gave the place away and gave the money to my ex-wife. And I came to Maui to live the Tao Te Ching for a year. And it was a calling. It was a calling to do that. So as you begin to make this shift away from ego, you begin to not be so attached to your stuff. And you don't even get attached to the ideas that you had about how important your stuff is. And then you begin to be less and less attached to needing to be able to prove anything. And you go within and you identify yourself on the basis of how much of a difference am I making? Who am I helping? That's what I said to the woman who wanted to be the comedian. It's like just one person's life, one moment in that person's life is better because of you. You got to count that in the success side of your life ledger that you're living, rather than I didn't make enough money, I didn't have enough bookings, I didn't get enough accolades and so on. You begin to let go of that. But the problem that we have is as we make this shift away from what's in it for me into how may I serve and what can I do for others, because that's really the essence of what the afternoon of your life really begins to look like. It begins to look like something that you probably never anticipated or could have even thought of when you were living through the ego. And that is that your life isn't about what you get. Remember, you are a piece of God. These hands that you look at, if they're the hands of God, they don't ask for anything. God doesn't say, I want some of this from you, I need some of that from you. Some of the people who misrepresented what God is do that and build big, lavish temples and, you know, gold, this and that and so on. But God doesn't ask for any of that. I've always said that the way that you show your love for God is not by building big, fancy temples and and lots of edifices and so on. The way that you show your love for God is by loving each other. The more that you are able to do that. And that's what I think the world is moving to. I know that it is. And I think that's going to be completed in another 3.5 years or so. So as the problem that people have when they're moving to the afternoon of their life is in what I just read to you from Carl Jung. He says, we cannot live the afternoon of life according to the program of life's morning. For what was great in the morning, what was really important for you in the morning, which was all of the things I just went through, that'll become little that evening. It won't even matter to you. And what in the morning was true, I mean, these were your truths. This is what you live by. You can see people who live strongly from the part of them that has edged God out and lives by this ego and their separation. Well, that evening have become a lie. Those things that you thought were absolute. So now if you're trying to do this by being more spiritual than somebody else, by proving that you're better than somebody else, you're still living in the same constructs. And he said, in the evening of your life, it becomes a lie. You begin to realize you're living a lie. So that the shift, the real shift here to meaning, is one in which instead of you reaching and saying, what's in it for me? How can I have more for me? why don't I get enough? And I think that's one of the places where I departed from The Secret. And I think that's really important to understand that, because I think The Secret was wonderful. I was asked to be a part of it, as a matter of fact, and I didn't, because I really think that they missed what I'm about to share with you from Lao Tzu, the oral traditions of Lao Tzu, is that that so much of it became about greed and what's in it for me and how much can I get, and if I think about it and I put it on a board and I want it for myself, that it's going to come to me. And I think there is some, there's great truth in that, and the awareness that it created for people is beautiful, that our thoughts are like things and that they are very, very powerful. And the more thoughts that you have about what it is that you want to create and what kind of a world you want to live in and what you'd like to have for yourself, that in itself is an energy. And I know that to be true. But I think that what it misses is that in the afternoon of our life, when we move into a place of purpose, that it is no longer about what I can get for myself, that you don't need to accumulate, you don't need to have more. As a matter of fact, having more almost becomes a burden. And so the more stuff that you accumulate, the more you want to keep it circulating, and the more your life becomes dedicated to reaching out and being godlike. And what is godlike? Giving, serving, loving, beauty, kindness, unconditional love. That's what it's like. And so you begin to live that. And then the irony of the ironies is, as you live that, you know, there's a story told of, I love this story, I haven't told it for a long time, of a little kitten who was out in the alley, and he was out there in the alley chasing his tail. He was chasing and chasing and chasing and chasing. And this old alley cat came along and stopped him and tapped him on the shoulder and said, What are you doing? And the little kitten said, oh, I've just returned from cat philosophy school. And in cat philosophy school, he said, we learned two things. Number one thing that we learned in cat philosophy school is that the most important thing in the world for a cat is happiness. And two, we learned that happiness is located in our tail. So I figured that if I just get a hold of it and grip it, so I'm going to get chase after it, and as soon as I get a hold of it and get it into my mouth, I'll have a lock on eternal happiness. And the old cat looked at it and said, you know, I've had to forage out in the alleys all of my life, and I've never really had the opportunity to go to philosophy school. But it's interesting. He said, I learned the very same thing that you learned in school out here in the alleys. I learned, number one, that the most important thing in the world for a cat is happiness. And indeed, I've discovered that it's located in my tail. He said, the only difference that I find between you and me is that I've discovered that when I go about my life and do the things that are really important, it follows after me wherever I go. In other words, you stop the chase and you let it start to chase you. And you take your attention off of what's in it for me and onto how may I serve. With the mantra of the ego is, what's in it for me? I need more, I need more, I need more. The mantra of the higher self, the mantra of the afternoon of your life, the mantra of your purposeful life, of your dharma, is not what's in it for me, but how may I serve? How can I be more God-realized? How can I act and think and behave like God thinks? And so the thing that I wanted to do when I did this film was to get that message across, that it's really not about trying to get more stuff for yourself. It's about really having your life make a difference, a significant difference. Now, I'm going to read you something that's really powerful. In fact, I have this underlined. I have it with me. I use this every day. And this is what I want to go into, the seven shifts that take place in our life that I've outlined for this seminar. He said, quote, if you wish to become a divine, immortal angel, then restore the angelic qualities of your being through virtue and service. This is the only way, underlined, this is the only way to gain the attention of the immortals who teach the methods of energy enhancement and integration that are necessary to reach the divine realm. In other words, you cannot reach this divine realm where you can manifest and attract what you put your attention on. You cannot do that unless you can shift to the qualities of virtue and service. He said, these angelic teachers cannot be sought out. That is, you don't get to go get them. It is they who seek out the student. In other words, they will seek you out. The guidance that you're looking for, the help that you want, the three or four calls that I heard at the end of the first hour were about how can I attract the right, whether it's the money, the right abundance, the right energy, whatever it is. Hear it again. These angelic teachers, these guides, this guidance, this divine guidance that's available to all of us, cannot be sought out. It is they who seek out the student. When you succeed in connecting your energy with the divine realm, that is, when you think like God thinks, which is what this whole seminar has been about, through higher awareness, which is what I'm speaking about now, and the practice of undiscriminating virtue, the transmission of the ultimate subtle truths will follow. They will follow. But you have to live the virtues. This is the path that all angels take to the divine realm. The mystical techniques for achieving immortality, that is, to be able to become a manifester and attract into your life what you want and live a life of purpose, the mystical techniques for achieving immortality are revealed only to those who have dissolved all ties to the gross worldly realm of duality, conflict, and dogma, that is, ego. I'll say it again. The mystical techniques for achieving immortality, the place you would like to get to, where every one of us want to get to, that life of purpose, where all things manifest for you, are revealed only to those who have dissolved all ties to the gross worldly realm of duality, conflict, and dogma. As long, here's his conclusion, as long as your shallow worldly ambitions exist, the door will not open. So the doorway that you want to open is going to open not because you say, this is what I want, and I'm going to just think about it, and I'm going to put it on a vision board, and I'm going to have everything just show up, and next Tuesday there's going to be a BMW in my driveway, and I'm going to have a new Rolex watch. It's not like that at all. That is still your connection to the gross worldly realm of this physical material world, where you have identified yourself, because that's what the ego is. The ego has edged God out and believed that you are this material being. You're not here as a human being having a spiritual experience. That's what the ego believes. I'm just here as a human being, and I have an occasional spiritual experience. The essence of this is that you are a spiritual being, an infinite spiritual being. That's your essence, having a temporary human experience. And you make your number one relationship not to yourself, not to your family, not to your spouse, not to your best friend. You make your number one relationship in life to your source, to your spirit, to that place from which you originated, the place to which you will return and come to know it for the first time. So he delineated four virtues. I'm just going to go through them real quickly here. The first of these four, he called them the cardinal virtues. When you start living these, and I want to tell you, every one of you, my friends, all of you who've signed up to listen to this today, and if you're listening to it, you know, years from now, even after I've left this planet, people will be listening to this. It's recorded. You've got to really get this, that you can live these virtues. And when you do, when you take your attention off of what's in it for me and what can I get, and onto how may I serve, and you practice these four cardinal virtues, then that's when the door will open. That's when the mystical techniques will be revealed to you. That's when you'll find yourself channeling, if you will. That's like when I just wrote Excuses Be Gone. I'm telling you, I sat down here in this very room where I'm speaking to you now, here in Maui, and I just let it come, and I just let it come. I didn't question it. I looked at this beautiful painting that someone sent me of Lao Tzu. It's almost like magical. It's like it speaks to me, and I just let it flow. And the doors open. That's when the doors open, because that's how I've been living my life. That's what I've been practicing, suspending the ego, pushing out the thoughts of that I am what I have and what I do and what others think of me, and I'm separate from everyone else, and I'm better than others, and I have more of this, and I'm smarter, and whatever it might be. Just letting all of that go and just focusing each moment of your life on these virtues. The first of these cardinal virtues is called Reverence for All of Life. And with Reverence for All of Life, this means that you not only have reverence for the people that you love, but you have reverence for the people that we've been told are our enemies. I mean, it's from Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount. You have been told to hate your enemies, and I say, no, I love your enemies. And those who persecute you, love them even more. Because if you don't have just love inside of you, you know, Patanjali put it this way. He said, when you are steadfast in your abstention of thoughts of harm directed towards yourself and others, that all living creatures will cease to feel fear in your presence. When you're steadfast. And what is steadfast means? It means you never slip. It means the only thing you have to give away is love, because that's what you are. And so you have reverence for all of life, reverence for those people who've been designated as your enemies, even the ones who are sworn to destroy you. You still have love in your heart for them. It was the love I gave to my father, who abandoned and walked out, but to send him love. And I feel his presence always. Always with me, on stage, right now when I'm speaking to you, when I write, I feel his presence always. And I feel sometimes that maybe, who knows how this universe works, maybe he signed up to just be able to teach one person, one son of his, how to forgive, and then I would be able to teach it to millions of people. And maybe he was the one who is responsible for so many of the people whose lives have been touched by the work that I've done over the last three or four decades. Who knows? Who knows? It's a possibility. Reverence for all of life doesn't just mean reverence for all human life. It means reverence for all of life. It means reverence for the planet. It means reverence for animals. It means not killing. It means being in a place of kindness and non-judgment towards everyone that you encounter. Reverence for all of life. Just practice it. The minute, you know, it's like, don't be one of those people who's looking for occasions to be offended. Somebody said things the wrong way. Somebody wore the wrong kind of clothes. Somebody used language that you don't like. Someone, you know, practices a different religion. Someone has a different cultural background. Someone lives on the other side of the river, whatever it is. You just let go of that. Just have reverence for all of life, all of the creatures of life, and all of our planet as well. That's the first cardinal virtue. And when you do, remember, he said, this is when the doors open, when you start practicing these. The second of these was called a natural sincerity, which is really manifests itself as honesty. So you get to a place where you practice being sincere and honest in all that you say and in all that you do. And it doesn't just mean honest doesn't mean I just don't steal. It means being honest as a human being. Like, what kind of a person am I? What do I want to be? And am I living that? So natural honesty. The third cardinal virtue, according to Lao Tzu, which will allow the doors to open, is gentleness, which manifests itself just as kindness. It means an absence of dominance, an absence of needing to make somebody else wrong and make yourself right. Just natural sincerity and gentleness, kindness. And the fourth is service. Service towards others. In other words, your life is dedicated not towards what's in it for me and what I can accumulate, but to how may I serve in any capacity, no matter where I am. And you can't call yourself a kind person because you're kind to your children and your neighbors, but you're not kind to the lady who cleans your toilets in the hotel, and you're not kind to the waiter who is having a little bit of a hard time, or you're not kind to the person who wants to get ahead of you on traffic, and you desperately go ahead. When you begin to practice these virtues, you find yourself letting people in. You find yourself not judging others. You find yourself being a little more patient. You find yourself stopping that the tongue lashing that you're about to unfurl inside of you, and instead seeing the unfolding of God in everything and everyone that you encounter. When you live from these virtues, this is when the door opens. This is, now let me go back and read you that final passage from Lao Tzu. The mystical techniques for achieving immortality are revealed only to those who have dissolved all ties to the gross worldly realm of duality, conflict, and dogma. As long as your shallow worldly ambitions exist, that is, your ego identification, the door simply will not open. The door to that magical place that you want to get to. And now, as I promised earlier, I'd like to go just to have a look at what this shift looks like, and then We'll take a few calls at the end, and we'll say goodbye. So we're going to go over a little bit, but not too much. So making the transformation from, or the transition rather, from the morning of your life to the afternoon of your life, to me, it involves these seven steps, the movements, the shift takes place. I'll just kind of go through them, and then we'll open up for some comments. You move away from ego by moving from turmoil in your life toward peace in your life. I always loved what Melville said in Moby Dick. Here was this man chasing Ahab, chasing after this white whale, but he really wasn't chasing after a whale. He was really chasing after his life's purpose. This is the thing that he was obsessed by. And he said, "For as this appalling ocean surrounds the verdant land, so in the soul of man lies one insular Tahiti, full of peace and joy, but encompassed by all of the horrors of the half-lived life." There's a place within you called Tahiti, peace and joy. And you move in your life, when you move into the afternoon of your life and you begin to live your life on purpose, where peace becomes something that you absolutely insist upon. I had a sign that I used to put in my dashboard of my car when I would drive my children to school. There were five of them at the same school one year, from pre-K to the eighth grade. And there was always somebody having an argument about who called shotgun and who got to set and who sat there next to me last week and blah, 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 blah. And I had a sign on there, and I'd make them stop, and I'd say, "What does that sign say? What does Daddy say there?" "I know, I know. I can choose peace rather than this," because that's what I had written on my dashboard. And I'd make them, each of them, read it out loud. "Daddy chooses peace rather than all of this craziness." So this comes about by letting go of your need to win, by refusing to be offended, by having no grievances, by practicing forgiveness, by having no judgment, by having silent places in your life, by being, I always say that when you have a choice in your life to be right or to be kind, always pick kind. Always pick kind. And then you just practice this in your life. And that shift away from the ego's need to be right and to win and to be into arguments, you release the emotions of fear and you release the emotions of guilt, and all you have left is peace. So from turmoil to peace is the first. The second shift that takes place as the shift away from the morning of your life and ego development into the meaning phase of your life is you move from deception to truth. You have a new commitment to truth. Here's where you resist boasting and exaggerating, and you move into that place where it's important that you walk your talk. I don't think there's much more important to me in my life at this point right now. If I meet someone and I say, "I'm going to send you something," or "I'm going to call," or "I'm going to," it's really important for me to remember to do that and to walk my talk. Not that I just don't, they would go through life lying, but to have a sense of who I am as a man, as a human being, is what I want to portray out there into the world. And if I'm not doing that, I want to be made aware of it. The third of these indicators away from in this shift is a movement from fear to love. As I pointed out earlier, the Course in Miracles says that there's only fear and love. That's all there is. And all that's fear can't be love, and all that's love can't be fear. So the way that you move away from fear, remember, the morning of your life, when the ego development, it's all about fear. It's all about being afraid I'm going to lose what I have, or I'm not going to get the promotion that I am entitled to, so I'm not going to be able to achieve, or people aren't going to like me, and I'm afraid that they won't like me. That's what the morning of your life looks like. The afternoon of your life is more in the movement of love wherever you go. That you start to practice acts of kindness as much as possible. You give yourself away. You begin to see that that love is the answer. I always say, when I wrote a book years ago called What Do You Really Want for Your Children, which is a book about how to raise children based on these principles. And whenever I sign an autographed copy of that book, I always say, teach only love. Teach only love. So, because whatever the question you have, love is the answer. So you move away from living in fear and the beauty of being in the afternoon of your life and living a meaningful, purposeful life is that love becomes the only response available to you because it's all you have to give away. The fourth of these shifts is from appearances to inner sustenance. The emphasis so much in our culture on particularly people in their as they don't have the doors open and wonder why, because they are not living from this place of inner sustenance. Appearances means, what does my body look like? What kind of grades do I get? How much money do I have? What kind of clothes am I wearing? Do I have the right labels on? What kind of jewelry do I have? And as you begin to move into the afternoon of your life, you remove the labels, not just from your clothes, but Kierkegaard, the great Danish theologian, said, once you label me, you negate me. You take all labels away from yourself. And what you do when you encounter other people is you don't look at what color their skin is or what color their eyes are or what they're wearing or what labels they have on them. You begin to look for the unfolding of God in everyone that you encounter. I don't know about you, but when I read the news about how many insurgents were killed over in Afghanistan, 30 were killed today, and some people applaud that as if that's good news. And I always think that's just more indication that as a people, we still haven't figured out a way to live together in harmony, to live together away from the appearances, the assumption that those people who were fighting in different places around the world, who believe just as strongly in their rights to raise their family, if we could reach out to them. And I loved what President Obama said in his inaugural address, that we'll extend a hand to you if you'll unclench your fist. It was perhaps the first time in the last couple of decades that we've extended a hand to begin to understand why there's so much hatred, why there's so much emphasis on appearances rather than on sustenance. And compassion is a big part of that inner sustenance, away from appearances. The Dalai Lama said recently in a talk I heard him give here on Maui, he said that if every child at the age of 5 were encouraged to meditate for 1 hour a week on compassion for their fellow human beings, and they did that for the rest of their life, that we could eliminate all violence and all hatred and all war on our planet in one generation. Just by getting young people from the age of 5 on to think compassion and caring rather than hatred and who's wrong. The fifth of these is from moving from striving to arriving. So much of the world of the ego is all about trying to get someplace else, never getting to arrive. I love the idea that Rumi said. He said, sell your cleverness and purchase bewilderment. Go through your life just being bewildered. Be in awe. Be in awe of everything that shows up. Arrive. Live here, in the moment, in this now. Everything that's ever happened to you in your entire lifetime, everything happened now. It happened in the present moment. It's all there ever is. And everything that's ever going to happen to you is going to happen to you in the present moment. So that your relationship to life is really your relationship to the present moment. And if you think God is going to be doing something different an hour from now than God is doing now, you still are living through the ego. God is going to be doing nothing different now than God was doing 1,000 years ago or 1 billion years ago. The universal source that is responsible for all of creation is only in the present. You don't have to try to get someplace else. Being here. My friend Ram Dass, who lives here on Maui with me, wrote a beautiful book back in the 60s called Be Here Now. And the truth is, that's all you can ever be. But the ego and the present moment cannot live simultaneously together. The ego is always concerned about where you're going and how quickly you're going to get there and how much you're going to have when you do and who's going to take away from you what you do have and so on. So move in your life from striving to arriving. Look around, even in this very moment. What do you see? Be in a state of appreciation, a state of bewilderment, a state of awe. Be able to stare at a spider web that just is this magnificent creation that we none of us can even begin to understand. Like, how did it get to be? I think that A spider, said Lao Tzu, is a perfect creature of Tao. Its body is an elegant expression of its mind. It spins beautiful threads, and its legs are exactly suited to create and walk its web. From its center, a spider radiates its world out with a spare economy. He said a spider's posture in regard to the Tao is to set up a pattern. Its mind determines this pattern. It realizes the flow of Tao and does nothing to interfere with it. It simply creates its pattern and waits for the Tao to bring its sustenance. That which comes to it, it accepts. That which does not come to it is in no way any of its concern. Once its web is established, a spider does not think of expanding unnaturally. It doesn't make war upon its neighbors. It doesn't go for adventures in other countries. It doesn't try to fly to the moon. It doesn't build factories. It doesn't try to enslave others. It doesn't try to be intellectual. It is simply who it is, and it's content with that. Become like a spider. The sixth of the seven movements from ambition to meaning is movement away from dominance and toward tolerance. Much more of allowing and letting things be. Much more curbing the need to be right and ignoring the past and having talks with God and your source. No judgments. Being a listener. Being able to no longer need to make somebody else wrong in order to make yourself look good. No need to dominate anyone. When you see someone doing something that you think that they shouldn't be doing, you can just silently observe that. When you see someone who's standing on a corner and wants to have some money and is begging, you don't have to give them money if you don't want to. You can give a silent blessing, but you don't have to curse them and talk and give a long lecture to yourself or to others about why they shouldn't be there. Nobody knows those stories. I remember not too long ago seeing a young man, he looked like he was in his 30s, standing there with a cup, and my first thought was, and I was on the telephone, I was talking to someone, and I was saying, here's a young guy, and he's out here, and he's begging, and, you know, he could be working. And then I noticed in the side view mirror as I was pulling away that he had only one leg, and his leg had been cut off at the up at the hip. And I stopped, and I reached in and gave him something. But I thought, it's so quick and so easy for us to judge, and we never even know. But so no longer needing to dominate anyone, and instead practicing something called radical humility. And the seventh of these seven movements from ambition to meaning, what happens is you move from toxicity in your life to purity. Not only in your what you put into your body, but in your thinking. You have an absence of prejudice. You no longer have addictive thinking or contrary thinking or comparison thinking. What happens is you begin to practice purity and moving away from toxicity. And it happens almost automatically. It's just amazing, everyone listening to me today, that as you begin to move into this direction of more peace and more kindness and more love and more giving and more surrendering and letting go and living a God-realized life, that the strangest things begin to happen to you. You start eating better. You're no longer attracted to foods that are just not good for you. You stop wanting to put addictive substances into your body. It happens almost automatically. It's almost as if like Vivekananda said, when you observe the blossoms on the fruit trees, the blossoms vanish of themselves as the fruit grows. So does this lower self, this toxic self. It begins to vanish as the divine grows within you. And you find yourself eating better. You find yourself not drinking as much. You find yourself not in toxic places, around toxic people. You don't go to dark places where there's a lot of smoke-filled things and where fighting breaks out and where people are angry or people are screaming at each other and so on. And you begin to look for more silence, which is much more purifying. The great French philosopher Blaise Pascal and scientist said that all of man's troubles stem from his inability to sit quietly in a room alone. You begin to become purer, not only in how you think and what you eat, but in who you hang out with and what you watch and even what you put on your television sets and listen to in your radio. If it isn't purifying, if it doesn't nourish your soul and your higher self, then you just kind of pass on it. And that's what I have to say to you today, my friends from all over the world. I appreciate and love you so much. I'd like to take just a few calls before we just close out. Who is it? Hi, Tracy in Nevada. Can you come on, my dear?
Hi there, Dr. Dyer.
Hi.
How are you?
Well, I've been talking for 2 hours. I don't know. Is anybody out there
great.
Listening?
Well, you know, I've been listening, and then I was cooking at the same time, and I set off the smoke detectors, and we had fire alarms in the house, and I missed the last half an hour.
Well, it's on recording, so you can get a copy of it. But
yes.
You know what? That's energy. I'm telling you, I'm not kidding either. Those kind of things happen. Lots of times when I'm being interviewed and I talk about these things, microphones go out, lights, burn out, and things like that happen. Everything is energy. So you must have been energizing your whole house.
Here, let me tell you.
Great.
Well, I just want to tell you, I love the movie. I saw it this weekend, and I'm going to get right to my question. In the scene when Shannon Sturgis is in the bathroom, and her husband comes in, and he wants to see her drawings, and
right.
she becomes very defensive and, withdraws. I find that that's happening to me a lot. I just came from, a couple years of high stress in the corporate world and got over it, and I'm trying to get back in touch with things that I want to do for myself. But when the people in my life ask about them, I'm scared to share. And I replayed that scene in the movie several times because it was me. And I just wanted to, ask, how do you get past that? How do you get past that fear of sharing?
Two things. Don't complain and don't explain.
Okay.
See, every time, Tracy, every time you try to explain what it is that you're feeling inside about, like in that scene where she wants to be, she's suspended her internal sort of knowing that her purpose there is artistic expression, even though she wants to be a great mom and so on, but she's pushed that all aside in the name of not really fulfilling her own destiny. The minute that you try to explain that to someone else, you go to the ego, because instantly what happens now is you have to explain why you're doing that, and then the other person is going to make you wrong or tell you reasons why that shouldn't be, or whatever it is that they have to say. Then once again, you go back to being dominated by something outside or external to yourself, and that's why it was so troubling for her. And he was just being nice and kind, but nevertheless, it was like so difficult for her because this is something that she had pushed aside and surrendered. What you have to do is acknowledge it and recognize it as valid and divine and important. And if you're feeling it and you have passion about it inside of you, that's all you need to know. And let go of, that need. And I think ultimately you saw that she began to shift herself, as you see in the movie when she stays there and he goes home and takes care of the children and so on, that he became much less of an enemy, how she was perceiving him, and much more of an ally. And that's what you want to do, is get those people in your life who perhaps wouldn't understand that to become your allies. And the way that you do that is you don't explain, you just do it.
You just be.
Yeah, I'm glad you enjoyed the film, though.
It was wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm very, very proud of that film, obviously. So.
Well, it was wonderful, I was actually on the treadmill the whole time I watched it, and I just couldn't stop watching, so I couldn't stop walking. It was great.
Oh, that's great. Look at how skinny you are now already.
I know.
That's great.
You're going to be in the fitness section and the spiritual section.
There you go. Well, thank you, my dear. Much love to you, sweetheart. I'm glad
thank
you're with
you
me
so
today.
Much. Namaste.
Thanks. God bless you. Namaste. Anthony in New Jersey. Hello?
Hello, Dr. Dyer. How are you?
Hi, Anthony. How are you, my friend?
Great, great. This has been a very powerful couple of hours.
Thank you.
I left my day job in October of 2002 because I felt that there was something that I wanted to do creatively, which at the time was in the shape of the entertainment business. I didn't know exactly what I was going to do, but I left it anyway with the support of my wife, who has been incredible over these past several years. I thought I wanted to be in the music business. So for the first 2 years, I was an engineer, audio engineer, producing music, and even singing a little. The money wasn't coming, but somehow the path led me to voiceovers. So I started doing voiceovers professionally. I studied, I marketed myself, and it's been a slow gain. Since 2004, but compared to what some of the veterans in the business and friends of mine that have been in the business for 20-some-odd years, I have been able to accomplish in 4 years what some people haven't been able to accomplish in those 20 years.
Right.
I was signed by, and still am represented by, some of the top agencies in the country. But
not that's your mistake, my friend. It's not a slow ride. All you have is now. All you have is this moment. And whatever it is that you're doing and activating in your life, you have a great voice, by the way. I don't know if you use that in your voiceovers as well.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you.
Very, very wonderful. It's very resonant. It's just, I feel like close to you just from your voice. I've been blessed with a voice that I had nothing to do with either. You know, I'm just grateful for it. But the problem with what you're saying, and I'm stopping because we have to go off the air in just a minute or so, is that it's not a slow ride at all. It's a perfect ride, and it's happening exactly at the pace that it's supposed to have. In the course, it says infinite patience produces immediate results. And what that means is that when you're infinitely patient, that means you infinite patience means you have unlimited patience. That means you know that whatever it is that you're putting your attention on is on its way, and it's just it's manifesting as it's supposed to. The immediate result that you get from that is peace. You're at peace with it. Instead of saying it should be happening at this pace in somebody else's way, that's all of the stuff I talked about with Ivan Illich where something else outside of you is controlling you. Just be totally at peace and enjoy of it. And I can feel the passion that you have for what it is that you're doing, and it comes through even in your voice.
Oh, yeah,
just
and I have a knowing. I have no doubt whatsoever that it's on its way.
Yeah, it's not only on its way, Anthony. I don't even think it's on its way. It's already here. Creation is already complete. It's already here. All you have to do is align with it. Just align with it.
Okay.
I would give you this recommendation. In your imagination, and everyone else listening as well, in your imagination, what you want to do is go whatever outcome it is that you would like to have, in your imagination, just go there, all right? And just see it, however that manifests for yourself, inside of, just in your mind. And then what I want you to do is to go to how does it feel when you think about what it is that you would like to have. What's the feeling that you have? Because the feelings are show up in the body. Whereas in the imagination, they show up in your mind. So every time you think about your voiceover business, whatever it is, you go to the feeling that you have from your imagination of it already being complete. So you're not thinking about the end. You're thinking from the end. And thinking from the end means, let's just say, if I were to ask you the question, how does it feel in your imagination to have this working the way you want it to? You'd say, it feels great. It feels solid. It feels joyful. Then every time you think about that, go to that feeling. Now, the most important thing I want to say to you is what you do the last 5 minutes before you go off to sleep at night. Instead of reviewing in your mind, in your consciousness, just before you slip into your unconscious or your subconscious state, what you don't want to review what's wrong, what's missing, what isn't working out, how slow it's working or anything like that. What you want to do is go to that feeling that you have from your imagination, that feeling of great, and then you let your subconscious mind for the next 8 hours marinate in that. Instead of marinating in all that isn't happening, you let it, and that's how creation takes place, through the subconscious mind. The subconscious mind then will go to work, however it does. I can't explain it, no one can, but it will begin to align you with what it is that you are feeling inside of you. And having that feeling, I have that written right by my bed every night before I go to bed. I have that little sign that says, you know, feel what it is that you would like to create for yourself before you go off to sleep. Feel that instead of reviewing anything that you don't want to happen. Because if you let your subconscious mind review all that isn't happening or isn't working, you'll keep manifesting that over and over in your life. Okay, my friend?
That's a great gift. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're very... By the way, a great book on that is by a guy named Neville, N-E-V-I-L-L-E. It's called The Power of Awareness. You can get it on the internet.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tony. God bless you. What a great voice.
Thank you.
I think you and I should get together and do a duet. Have you seen the movie?
Yes, I have. Yes,
great.
I have.
What did you think?
Oh, it was just so enlightening, and it's exactly what was missing in the other more famous movie.
In The Secret, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to make it the shift, and we need people like you to tell the whole world about it. We'll shift this whole planet in the next few years.
And that's perfect that you bring that up. That word has come up so many times recently. It's just perfect.
Great. Thanks, Tony. God bless
you,
my friend.
You too.
And thank all of you. You're all beautiful. I love you all. And I say to you, sayonara, ciao, aloha, mahalo. I love you. Namaste.
We hope you've enjoyed this live online seminar with Dr. Wayne Dyer. Discover more about his upcoming film, Ambition to Meaning, by going to the website DyerMovie.com or AmbitionToMeaning.com. Also, you can visit HayHouse.com and be sure to join him for his radio program, Dr. Wayne Dyer's Inspiration, every Monday at 1 Pacific, 4 Eastern on HayHouseRadio.com. And thank you for joining us today.